Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us on another Sunday. Today we're going to talk about the history and tales of UVA's pep band. Our guest today, we have Ed Miller with us. He's the associate editor at Virginia Magazine. He's also the author of a recent article called Pep Band, The Pep Band's 30 Years of Scrambling on the Edge. Welcome, Ed.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
We also have Ron Culberson. Ron is a speaker, author, and humorist. Ron was also a member of the Pep Band from 79 to 83 on the writing committee, as well as a field conductor in 1982. Ron, thanks for being here with us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, I was a big fan of the Pep Band. I went to school at UVA from 82 to 89 and then remained in Charlottesville and attended numerous football games throughout the demise of the Pep Band, and was always a supporter found it highly entertaining. So I was very excited and entertained by the article, Ed. I found that quite enjoyable. And Ron, a big supporter of the band in general. But I want to start, not everybody knows UVA's Pep Band. If you went to the school, hopefully so during that time period. But certainly there are listeners today who are unfamiliar, whether it's because you went to a different school, you have no idea what a pep band, scramble band is. Ron, can you take on that task for us?
Sure. So a scramble band, from our perspective, was based on the Ivy League schools, where they didn't have traditional marching bands. Instead, they had scramble bands, which were basically joke bands. We did jokes, we did a formation, and we did music. That was the simple formula. 8 to 10 of those per game, where you would tell a joke, form a picture on the field, and then play a piece of music that went with it. So, for instance, one of the classic jokes that was used several times over the years was the announcer would come on the loudspeaker, and the announcer, by the way, was one of our band members who was up in the press box. We would write the script, and he would deliver it, and he would say something like, "Would the owner of $10,000 in small, unmarked, non-sequential bills wrapped in rubber bands please report to the ticket office? We have your rubber bands." And then, so then we would form something like a dollar sign on the field, and we might play, you know, the song Money from Pink Floyd. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that we would do. And we'd have 8 to 10 of those per show, often targeting either the opposing team, current events, or the terrible food in the cafeteria, which was a common topic as well.
So you were a member of the band. Ed, what was your personal connection that made you want to write this article about the history of UVA's Pep Band?
Well, in a previous life, I was a sports writer for many years and covered UVA now and then, UVA football in particular. And so I was familiar with the Pep Band and, in fact, was there for their last show, which came in 2002, and which we discuss in the article. So we were looking at this issue, and it was a subject I think they wanted to tackle for a while. And my editor said, "I think you're the guy to do it," because I had some familiarity with it. We wanted to kind of keep it light and fun, and in particular in this issue with everything that's been going on in the world and with the COVID and some of our other issues, you know, had dealt with that. And so we thought, we'll just try to give people a little bit of a break and, you know, try to do something fun. So I had seen the Pep Band perform a couple times, wrote a couple stories when I worked down in Norfolk at the Virginian Pilot. newspaper about the Pep Band and some of the controversy that surrounded it in its, you know, in its later years.
So tell me the challenges of putting this article together.
The biggest challenge was I think I had about 40 or maybe more pages of notes just from talking to as many people as I could from throughout the Pep Band's 30-year history. So that included people from the early the mid-1970s all the way up through 2002 and 2003, and even some people who were in another iteration of what was called the Pep Band back in the 60s, although it wasn't the same organization. It wasn't the same type of band. It was a more traditional band. So I would say the biggest challenge was just sifting through all that material, finding the best stuff, and then trying to tell it in a way that people could follow chronologically, but also, you know, that it was entertaining and wasn't dry. So it was a lot of fun to write. I mean, people like Ron, who I talked to, had great stories. And there was this real spirit of camaraderie among all the Pep Band members from different generations, if you will. And there was a great sense of institutional knowledge. I mean, people that were in the band in the early 2000s knew some of the lore from 25 or 30 years before that. So there was a real sense of pride in the band, and I wanted to try to, you know, bring that out in the story if I could. So it was a lot of fun to write, and gotten some pretty good reaction so far.
Now, Ron, you were a member as well as being a field conductor. Were you ever up in the press box doing the pieces up there?
What we did, the way this worked was that an individual got elected basically to be the announcer, because that was a pretty prestigious job. The field conductor job was basically your job was to run the show committee, which was charged with writing the jokes, putting together the formations, and picking the music. So as pay for that, they let you go out and direct the band on the field. Even though the guy that did it with me, we partnered one year. We were co-field conductors. We had no experience whatsoever in conducting, but you didn't really have to. But I only went up in the press box a couple of times to do voices. I was the voice of Mr. Rogers for a skit we did one time, and I think I did somebody else, but I can't for the life of me remember what it was. But otherwise, that job went to the person who actually auditioned and was elected to be the announcer for the year. And generally, you might have the same person for a couple of years if they were good at it, because you wanted to have that continuity.
I asked because I was wondering if you could do the official name of the band for folks.
Oh, sure. So there was always some sort of lead-in at the beginning of this. At the beginning of we also did the pregame and then the halftime. So we came in on the field twice, and the pregame was really, we might make one joke, but it is generally just the national anthem and then the Cavalier song. But there was always some sort of lead-in that allowed us to then say, it's the award-winning University of Virginia Fighting Cavalier Indoor-Outdoor Precision Marching Pep Band and Chowder Society Review Unlimited.
That
was the full name.
Why such a long name? And what is Chowder Society Review?
Now, you know, it's so funny you ask that, because I was going through my notes earlier today, and I thought, I bet he's going to ask what a Chowder Society is. And I have no idea, although I looked it up, and there's a couple of different definitions online about what it is. But it's basically I think it had some ties to political groups back a long, long time ago. But I saw one definition that said it was a group of people who controlled themselves and were not controlled by outside regulations. And I said, well, that's the definition I'm going to go with, because that fits the Pep Band to a T. But I'll tell you why the long name. I think it was just that's the personality of the band. We did not. I saw a bumper sticker one time that said, "I march to a different accordion," and I think that's exactly what the Pep Band was. And at the beginning of the document where Steve Mershon presented all of this to the administration and to the athletic department, there was a quote at the beginning of his long description of what this should be about. And it was a quote from the Stanford band who were also a scramble band. It was a quote from their handbook that said, it was just a quote from someone else that said, "Your band was everything a university band shouldn't be. And we loved it." And I think that's kind of what the personality of the band was. It was like, if somebody zigged, we zagged. And the idea was to do that so that we were different and unique, but also clever and funny. So that was kind of the motivation of it all.
So, Ed, when you're putting this together, you've got all this material. Can you give us a little bit of history? How did the band come about? Ron mentioned a name, but who and when and why did this all start? Because it doesn't go back to the 1890s.
Right. First of all, I'm really impressed with Ron's ability to recite that name by memory. That's impressive because that's a long name.
We did it a lot.
yeah. And I had forgotten that until I was doing the story. I said, "Oh yeah, they do have a formal name." And it was just a Pep Band. But it all started in the early 70s. A guy named Steve Mershon was kind of the point man on getting the band together. And there were a couple other people that were involved as well. He was doing some graduate work at UVA. And he had been in the previous iteration of the Pep Band in the 60s, which was really the music department had kind of fallen on hard times. To go way, way back, there was a band dating from about in the mid-1930s and that played in football games, and they were making a trip up to Yale for a game in the early 40s. The band bus caught fire, and basically the uniforms and a lot of the instruments were lost. So the band kind of just limped on for another 15 years or so. In the late 50s, early 60s, there wasn't much of a band presence at Virginia at all. There were a lot of high school bands would play at the football games. And really, it was kind of keeping with the way a lot of Virginia students preferred it. They didn't want to be regarded as what they called it, a state U. They felt like they were, a little different. Didn't want a traditional regimented sort of militaristic marching band like a lot of schools have. So, but Steve said he had read an article sometime in the late 60s, early 70s about it might have been the Columbia University band or one of the Ivy League scramble bands in the New York Times. And he thought it would be a great fit at UVA, which, kind of did regard it, and I think still regards itself as kind of a public Ivy League school. And, a good fit with the culture at Virginia. So he it took him a good year or so of planning. And as Ron mentioned, they put together a proposal. They got official approval from the athletic department, from the Board of Visitors. And they debuted in 1974 against William & Mary at Scott Stadium. And, of course, in those days, Virginia football was, honestly not very good. A lot of people would leave at halftime and not come back. So that was a way of sort of holding people's interest at halftime of these for this hapless football team. So they started in 74 and got it off the ground with some shows. And as Steve had said, his first one of his major intentions was to be funny without being offensive. Some of the Ivy League bands, were a lot edgier, to be honest, than Virginia was. But it was a different kind of, different scale, if you will. Ivy League football, you might play in front of 3,000 or 4,000 people in those days. At Virginia, even when they weren't very good, it was just you know, a lot more went into it. They were in the ACC. So he wanted to be funny without being offensive, but they sort of got away from that in subsequent years and, you know, began offending people, which is really what a lot of people remember the Pep Band for.
Yeah, it is what people remember them for, and we'll do that throughout the hour. Some of the more, I'll use the term memorable and well-remembered pieces. Ron, do you want to talk about a couple as I list them, and hopefully you're up to, because I'm sure they're on the wall of fame slash shame somewhere. Can you do the talk about the UVA Rutgers game in the fall of 1980 and the piece on the Rutgers marching band?
And I think, you know, I don't remember any particular controversy coming from that, because I was there that year and I don't remember any fallout.
But I think that's sort of like, and I guess I didn't phrase that well in terms of that's not controversial as well as that may not be, but it can certainly be construed as offensive.
Yeah. So, and let me put a filter on this for anybody that's listening, because I think we need to understand that it was a different era, and there was different sensibilities, and there were different filters with which people viewed humor and comedy, and things are very different today. But you know, as we always targeted our opposing team when we were at home, and that's just what we did. But we were playing Rutgers, and the announcer came on and said, "We regret to inform you that the Rutgers University Marching Scarlet Knights could not be here this afternoon. We understood that complications arose on their way to Charlottesville. Upon crossing the Jersey state line, half the band applied for political asylum, and the other half died from overexposure to clean air." And so that was the joke. I mean, because that was the stereotypical New Jersey joke for many, many years, you know, probably not 100% accurate, but that was the stereotype.
Oh, my. And then, of course, jokes against Virginia Tech, the primary rival, were... were quite the scene, correct?
Yes. That was our pinnacle game every year, as it is today. I mean, you know, the team works towards that game as the highlight of every year, and we work towards it every year as the highlight of our show. So some of the best jokes that we wrote throughout the year would get filed away in the tech show because we wanted to save some of the better ones for that. And I think, you know, again, it was about trying to be clever and funny. And as Steve Mershon said, if we inadvertently offended, that was not the goal. The goal was to be funny. And if in the process we inadvertently offended, we certainly, you know, would take responsibility for that. But that was not the target.
Well, we're going to take a break and in just a moment. And then when we come back, I want to talk about some of the Virginia Tech games, certainly the 1974 game in particular. But from there, because it seems like at that time in 1974, that was the first fall season with the Pep Band. And then we go to 2002, and that's the last season of the Pep Band. So we're talking about the history and tales of UVA's Pep Band. Ed Miller, associate editor at Virginia Magazine and author of a recent article on the Pep Band. Ron Culberson, he's a speaker, author, humorist, and also a former member of the Pep Band. Hang tight, everybody. We'll be right back. And thank you so much for being with us today as we talk about UVA's Pep Band. Fans, not fans, folks who were going, I don't know what that is. Hopefully you're transfixed by the stories and the tales, because we're about to jump in to talk about one of the initial landmark incidents for the Pep Band. Virginia Tech game of October 1974. Ed, you talk about this in your article about the Pep Band in the Virginia magazine, that one of the most recent issue that came out. So tell us more, please.
Yeah, so there's this Pep Band, and as I said before, Steve Mershon is very conscious of not wanting to offend. And, you know, but it, like and Ron had said earlier, it was the era, you know, sensibilities were different. And, you know, Saturday Night Live, I think, was getting ready to take off. It was just kind of a maybe a little more irreverent time. So, but, you know, here come the Hokies. So it's hard to resist. You know, the jokes just kind of write themselves, I guess. So they go out there and they form an H in the middle of the field. And then the announcer says, you know, could you turn the H around? The Hokie fans couldn't read it on the other side. So, you know, kind of subtle. And then all this is on YouTube, by the way. It's fun to watch. It's about 10 minutes altogether.
And unless you're a tech graduate who right now is cursing us, but
right.
Nonetheless, yeah. But still listening, I'm sure.
But this was all kind of unprecedented, I think. I think it probably took, you know, the Hokies by surprise. I don't think they knew what they were walking into. So you have the Marching Virginians, which is the Hokie band, which is a traditional band and a very good one from what I understand. And the Heidi Tidies, who were the military, the regimental band, the ROTC unit, couldn't make it. And so the punchline comes, you know, as you all know, it's harvest time at Blacksburg. So, you know, so sort of some pretty basic jokes about, you know, the agricultural rural school as opposed to the state university. So while this was happening, a couple of Tech band members sort of positioned themselves near midfield. And as the Virginia band was marching towards the far end zone, not the end zone opposite of the hill, they ran out and grabbed the conductor's baton, which was a giant turkey leg. I think it was paper mache. And they took it and ran back to their band and held it up like a trophy. So, you know, Virginia wasn't going to stand for that. So a couple of band members from Virginia ran down there and, you know, relieved the Hokie bird of a couple pieces of his costume and then ran back with that. And the crowd was really eating it up, according, you know, listening to the video. They were just chanting, you know, go Wahoos go. And I couldn't help but think, you know, if that happened today, it would probably, you know, make headlines or there'd be, you know, there'd be, it would be a much bigger deal. It seemed like the whole thing was kind of shrugged off. You know, they finished the show. The announcer, the official PA announcer, got back on the mic and just said, you know, senior day here at Scott Stadium. And, you know, kind of as if nothing much had happened. So that was kind of when they first crossed the line, I guess you will. Although, again, it wasn't really much. And Steve Mershon told me, he's like, yeah, he kind of was a little wary of what they had kind of unleashed. So he sort of doubled down on the idea of, you know, trying to be funny without being offensive. When they go on the road, he found it was best to make fun of your opponent's rival. So if you went to North Carolina, you'd make fun of NC State. You know, if you went to Georgia Tech, you'd make fun of Georgia, that kind of thing. That was a way to win the opposing crowd over. But I think that, you know, there was something that was kind of sparked there. And in subsequent years, you know, it would just kind of go in another direction, you know, altogether.
You know, just to if I could tag along on that, you know, you think about the movie Animal House and you think about how in the old days, how rival fraternities might play practical jokes on other fraternities, or rival schools would go in and, you know, paint something on the football field, or which has happened over the years at UVA and Tech, and it happens among all rival schools. One year when we went down to play Tech at Blacksburg, you know, we're driving in our bus down there, and Actually, I think we were in our personal cars, but that doesn't really matter. And I drove under one of the underpasses, and they had a huge sheet that was holding, they were holding over the underpass so that you would see it as you went under. And it said, prevent birth defects, sterilize wahoos. And so, you know, I think there was this this era, if you will, in colleges back then that really was a lot like the Animal House movie. It was just it was like you were battling and you were playing these practical jokes, and it wasn't necessarily viewed through the lens of this is really offensive and should not be allowed. It was really like, who's going to get the upper hand? It was kind of how I think people saw it. And there were, that kind of thing happened all the time back then. I think that happens less today. So it feels a little different when you hear the story about how they, you know, they run on the field and steal the baton, or they tear apart the mascot. That just seems crazy. But I'm not sure back then it was really that crazy.
Well, it hasn't been that long ago since someone from Virginia Tech, assumedly, or a Virginia Tech supporter, somehow broke into Scott Stadium and painted a maroon T next to the UVA logo on in the center of the field before the Virginia Tech football game. So it may have been a decade ago now. My sense of time gets blurry on that sort of thing, but it wasn't 40 years ago. It wasn't 20 years ago.
What is it? Our parents used to say, it's all fun and games until somebody gets hurt. And that's kind of how I think we all viewed that kind of thing, is that, yeah, oh man, they got it. They did something we never even thought of, or we got them on this time. And, you know, it was kind of fun in a competitive way. And I think, you know, some of the times that the pep band got into trouble, if you look at what was actually done, it was pretty mild-mannered, but somebody just got really upset with it.
When the adults could get involved is when things would kind of, you know, escalate, whether it was, a governor or an athletic director at another school, which happened on several occasions. But as Ron said, you know, there was this back and forth that rivals have, and you see it even now, I think, with the, you know, Army, Navy, the service academies. And UVA, one of the things when I talked to people, they said they wished that, you know, people that were in the pep band kind of wished that somebody would have come back at them. They would have loved it if someone had, you know, had a similar band and made fun of Virginia, whatever that might have been. But being in the ACC, UVA was an outlier, you know, with a pep band. Everyone had a traditional band. There was no other similar band in the conference, unlike the Ivy League, where basically all the bands were, scramble bands. Stanford is in kind of the same position out in on the West Coast. And I think Rice University I don't know if they still do or not, but they had a scramble band as well. And they were, of course, in Texas, where football is really taken extremely seriously. So, part of it was just, you know, UVA was an outlier. And I think as athletics got bigger and there was more at stake, you know, sort of a predictable reaction was that the people in charge of it would, you know, maybe step in and say, you can't do that.
To your point, when you said that go ahead.
Well, we're talking about adults overseeing things. The athletic department was supposed to do some of this, correct? I mean, the university's pep band couldn't have been on the field without the okay from someone at the university. They may have been a student-run, student-governed, award-winning Virginia Fighting Cavalier indoor, outdoor, precision marching pep band and Chowder Society Review Unlimited. But someone at the university had to give them an okay to be out there every Saturday. And as you go through time, someone at the athletic department oversees the scripts and approves it. And in the beginning, that was Gene Corrigan.
Right. Right.
And,
yes,
and at what point, does anyone get upset in the beginning? At what point does someone start wagging their finger in the beginning? Does Gene Corrigan ever do that and say, no, 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 that's not good? You, instead of just chuckling and saying good line or turning their back to it.
Well, I think what originally happened was there was a not quite as a scrutinizing review as it was until after the Maryland game in 1977. When the Pep Band came out and introduced their honorary conductor for the day, and it was Marvin Mandel, who was the governor, the former governor who was in jail. And he came out in a striped outfit with a ball and chain. And now this was truth. The guy was in jail for, and I don't know what the crimes were that he committed, but my understanding from people who were there said the Maryland fans actually cheered. But the acting governor at the time was very upset with this and, you know, even contacted the governor of Virginia for a formal apology. And that instituted what I think was the first strict censoring of the show, where every Friday we had to go before the athletic director or his appointee and share our show. And he would go through it with a red pen. He'd go, that's fine. That's fine. Well, you know, you can't do that one. That's fine. And when I was there, it was Dick Schultz, and he was just he was a great guy. I mean, he was very reasonable. You know, we always went in there with something super edgy, hoping that the things that were on the fence would slide through. And they knew that. They knew what we were doing. It wasn't like we weren't all in on the joke, but he was very reasonable. He didn't mind, you know, letting something slide that was a little bit edgy. But he was very clear. He says, you can't do that. And we respected him for that because we felt like he was being fair to us. He wasn't treating us, you know, with a heavy hand, if you will. I think in later years, as some of the other incidents came about, then perhaps the athletic department took a tighter rein, and they, you know, they got a little more heavy handed in what they would let through until the point in the mid to late 90s when they actually just took away the microphone completely. But yeah, we had to go through that. So they signed off on it. Whatever we did, they signed off on. And, you know, the idea was you don't change that then. You don't go out there and do something they didn't sign off on. But I felt they were very fair when we were there for most of the material that we presented to them.
Well, Ron, you're quoted in Ed's article as saying sheep jokes almost always got canned.
Yeah. I don't know why that was a go-to. as a 60-year-old adult, I'm not really sure why we ever would go back and forth about sheep jokes. But yeah, you know, that's the kind of stuff that was again, you know, in my mind, in current standards, is probably not super offensive. But they never got approved.
Go ahead, Ed.
I was just to follow up on what Ron said about the Maryland game. Marvin Mandel was indeed, you know, convicted. It was mail fraud and racketeering. And so the Maryland athletic director, Jim Kehoe, you know, complained to Gene Corrigan, you know, being a counterpart AD, and Blair Lee, who was the acting governor who succeeded Mandel. He really went crazy with it too. So I think, like I was saying, once those kind of things happen, it sort of puts pressure on the administration to respond in kind. And as Ron mentioned, the oversight did get heavier in subsequent years. I just have this great image of, you know, Gene Corrigan sitting there looking at the script, crossing things out, you know, or Dick Schultz. And, you know, these two guys who were really the giants in athletics, I mean, who became, you know, NCAA directors. And they're sitting there looking at these jokes. And, you know, in the mid-80s at some point, they formed a review committee because I think it, you know, the AD probably had better things to do at that point than, you know, try to be a editor, you know, or a censor, if you will, of the Pep Band.
Ed, I think another, I don't have this marked in quotes on my notes here, but you list Gene Corrigan, not as he didn't want to be known as the band's illegitimate father, but as the father of the illegitimate pep band.
Yeah, so that kind of tells you what kind of guy Gene was, you know, good sense of humor and sort of got the spirit of the whole thing. And, you know, he had gone on to Notre Dame at that point. Dick Schultz came in, and then later Jim Copeland came in, and Jim, I guess, you know, maybe didn't have the same, didn't look at things the same way. And as Ron said, at a certain point, they just said, you guys are done. They took their mic away. I think this was in 93, and the pep band historians, if you will, refer to it as the revolution of 93, where they actually brought in a what was called the sports band. It was hastily put together and had, you know, had some students, and they would also get guest college bands to play. So the pep band went on strike and said, well, if we can't have our microphone, we're not going to play. So there was a lot of debate back and forth, a lot of op-eds in the student press. And eventually, I guess the pep band won that battle, and they got back on the field in 93. But from what people said, it wasn't quite the same after that. They felt like, you know, they just didn't have as much latitude to be as funny as they wanted to be.
Again, our show today is on the history with some tales of University of Virginia's pep band. We have Ron Culberson here. He was a member of the pep band. And we have Ed Miller, who wrote an article on the history of the pep band, the 30 years of scrambling on the edge. And you can find that in Virginia Magazine. Let's take our second break and come back. I want to talk about a number of the well-remembered pieces. There's the Sugar Bowl with Elvis. There's the first West Virginia incident that really sort of set up for the second incident. There's always something else with Virginia Tech. And then I want to know how the football coaches felt about the pep band. So hang tight, everybody. We will return. And thanks for being here with us again today on the Wren Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, talking about UVA's pep band. For those who don't know what a pep band was before we started, no ideas of a scramble band. Hopefully you've learned a little more. Fans of the pep band, reliving your memories. And those who weren't interested, just listening anyway, because you never know when your school's name may come up in the jokes. We have Ed Miller and Ron Culberson here helping us tell the tales. So I want to, there's always another Virginia Tech joke, but here's one that always made me laugh when I'm reading through some of the well-remembered pieces online. So the pep band goes out there. I guess Duke is in the house, and they're welcoming the marching band from Duke. And so they welcome the Duke University marching band by making a D, a U, an M, and a B. I mean, it's just simple, funny stuff like that. You spell dumb.
Yeah. A lot of it was not, necessarily overthinking this stuff. It was just coming up with silly kinds of comments or silly kinds of, jokes about whatever was going on. And obviously they're going to pull out stereotypes. I know we talk about Tech or West Virginia, and those are more rural areas. So that's obviously going to be the theme, the same way, you know, the New Jersey joke was going to be playing off of sort of the stereotype of New Jersey. But it just, you know, it was not overly cerebral all the time, although there were some. I know one joke got cut because the athletic department felt that people wouldn't get it. And we just thought that was hysterical. Because it wasn't that complicated.
And how did the coaches, football coaches, feel about all that? Because it went from, I guess, Sonny Randall in the very early days through Dick Bestwick when the teams were still very bad. But then George Welsh got here, and they really had some great times. And then Al Groh took over, and they had sort of a mixed time period. What about that?
Yeah, I'm not sure George Welsh ever gave the band a second thought. I mean, I just from what I knew of George and covering him a little bit, you know, and again, it was, even though George was really the, you know, the father of modern Virginia football, I mean, he took the program to made it not only respectable, but it was nationally relevant, you know. And but still, I think it was just kind of accepted that Virginia had this irreverent band, this pep band. I do know that Al Groh, who I covered a bit more, Al was a big fan of traditional marching bands. I don't know how much influence Al had, but I'd go to his press conferences, and sometimes for whatever reason, you know, you sort of get off topic. And there was a guy who was one of the reporters from the Associated Press who had gone to Ohio University, and Ohio University's band came in there to play. I think they were a guest when the pep band was in timeout. And so there was this kind of running joke about the Ohio University marching 110. And Al wanted to change a lot of things. Like, he wanted people to stop wearing ties to games and things like that. He wanted fans to just show up in, you know, T-shirts and more traditional sweatshirts and you know, what you think of as football attire. As you know, and the longstanding tradition at Virginia was that the gentlemen wore ties to the games. So I think Al was probably not a fan, but I don't think either one of them really, you know, wasted much time thinking about the band. You know, they were trying to win football games, and football became, you know, more important. I mean, in the ACC, it became, you know, Florida State joined, and it, you know, used to be just a basketball conference. Football started becoming more of an economic engine, you know, for the ACC and for Virginia. So, you know, there was just more at stake. And I think, you know, at the end, they felt like they needed a band that kind of reflected that seriousness of purpose, you know, that they needed. They did, you know, we're a serious football school program, and we have this jokey band. So I think it was just, as Ron said, I think in the article, you know, times changed, you know, the sensibilities changed, and, you know, the pep band sort of ran its course.
I think, you know, just if I can tag on to that, I was just going to add on to that, that if you, I have all the materials and a lot of letters and a lot of correspondence over the years. And if you look at any given time throughout the history of the band, there are letters that the coaches sent to the band thanking them for their performance or thanking them for their support or showing up at a game or showing up at a practice or showing up at a non-premier sporting event. And so I think at any given time, the coaches were appreciative of the band's participation because they did perform at soccer games and at lacrosse games and some other things. But I think then, you know, if there was any kind of controversy or anything, you know, it was hard for the coaches to necessarily support that if it went against their goals. So I think it varied over time.
Well, I want to get these things in here so that we can talk about the demise. Because while the pep band supported the other sports, which was important, they didn't just play at the football games. They went to the swimming games, the lacrosse games, the baseball games, and every other sport. And we need to make mention of that. And I've failed to do that. And it's great to have you bring that up, Ron. But our time is limited. And to me, there's three big events left that need to make mention so that listeners who are unaware or want to take note of, we have the Sugar Bowl with Elvis. We have the two West Virginia events. The first one with the Family Feud style that upset West Virginia football so that when the 2002 Continental Bowl took place, we ended up with the complaints that led to where we are now. So let's talk about the Sugar Bowl first. Ron, Ed, who's taking that on?
So I was reviewing some of the notes. I've got a lot of stuff, and it's almost overwhelming how much material I have to try to sort through. But I went back and read what happened at that, because I was not there. But essentially what happened was is that they were playing the University of Tennessee in the Sugar Bowl, and they brought a guy dressed like Elvis out on the field. And then essentially the band jumped on top of him, and the announcer said, "Well, ladies and gentlemen, the mystery is solved. Elvis is finally dead." So the joke was commenting on the fact that there are all these Elvis sightings, and there are people that believe conspiracy theories that Elvis is not dead. The joke was not necessarily an anti-Elvis joke. I think if you look at the mechanics of the joke, it was commenting on the belief that Elvis wasn't dead. But the crowd took that very personally because Elvis was huge in Tennessee. So that was just something that that was not acceptable. And that was one of the major controversies.
The other part of the joke is, for those who are sports fans, the Tennessee nickname is the Volunteers. They're the Tennessee Volunteers. So once Elvis was put down, the announcer said, "We need some help removing Elvis from the building. Are there any volunteers in the house?"
Yeah, I must have missed that.
And of course, there's 60,000 people there who are there to support Tennessee.
Yeah. So that's a just to put on my humor hat here. That's a very clever joke. We can debate the offensiveness of it probably till the cows come home. But the mechanics of that are pretty clever. But yeah, so that was what set off again, we had governor to governor talking and complaining about the antics of the band. So that was the Tennessee game.
Well, we have, and then there's the two West Virginia issues, and they're set at different time periods. The first, Virginia bothers the West Virginia crowd and state politicians with a family feud bit. Can anyone go through that, or do I need to do that?
I was actually at that game.
Okay.
I'll let Ed do it because I've had my time telling the jokes.
No, it's okay. I was not at that game, but just from, and Ron can fill it in here maybe, but they made, the sort of stereotypical jokes about indoor plumbing or the lack of it in West Virginia. And also I think birth control was another topic. And I'm not sure how that came up in the context of the game show format, but as you guys said, official offense was taken, so it got to the gubernatorial level, and apparently they had a long memory because jumping ahead a little bit in 2002, they were sort of primed, waiting for something, and the Pep Band delivered. They did this Bachelor skit. Which, there was a UVA bachelor and there were two bachelorettes, one who was a Wahoo, one who was a WVU student. And the WVU student was wearing denim overalls with pigtails and did a little square dance and said that she was, they stole a line from the Beverly Hillbillies, going to move to Beverly, swimming pools, movie stars, that kind of stuff. So yeah, just kind of a fraught relationship with the neighboring state of West Virginia. I know that the guy who wrote that show, Alex Hamm, told me that they could have played Country Roads and it wouldn't have really mattered. they were going to get booed by the WVU fans. And in fairness, they probably weren't in the best mood because Virginia was really putting it on them that day. And then the Continental Tire Bowl, they ended up winning like 48-22. So you've got this fan base that's kind of annoyed by the way their team is playing. You've got this neighboring state with a history of, you know, poking fun at you. And it was sort of the perfect storm for, you know, what happened. And then, of course, the governor of West Virginia took offense and, you know, demanded apologies. And I think Virginia ended up providing them. And then, you know, that wasn't the beginning of the end, because I think the end had been in works for a while, but that was sort of the precipitating event that, you know, was the end of the Pep Band.
Now, that was the last show played, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yes. It was the last football show. Yeah. And much of the article, and I'm glad Ron brought up the fact that they did play at other, because there really was this culture of, as they called it, you know, culture of service to the athletic department. And let's keep in mind here that they were doing it all for free. So, you know, it wasn't costing the university really anything financially anyway to, you know, to have this band that they would show up at a swim meet. I mean, if you can imagine a band, you know, playing at a swim meet or, you know, a lacrosse match or soccer or, you know, where traditionally you wouldn't get that kind of support. And, you know, as it turns out, most of the headlines came from football games because that's the highest profile sport with a band, you know, a halftime show. But they did, the coaches from those other sports were very appreciative of the Pep Band.
And actually, after that last game, they still tried to garner support and tried to perform at various events and be a presence at the university, but just didn't have the support of the administration of the athletic department at that point to be a formal, you know, organization that could be, you know, placed at different events and be part of the culture at that point. So it's just kind of eventually just, you know, they dwindled and I think probably I'm going to guess in like 2011, 2012, kind of the end of their presence at the university. They had a group called the Friends of the Virginia Pep Band that really worked hard to keep them going, but just didn't have a lot of organizational support.
We've got about 4 minutes left here to talk about UVA's Pep Band with Ed Miller and Ron Culberson. So, Ed, your article talks about at this point, the UVA fills in with a variety of groups, and then this is where the marching band starts to be built. Donations come about, and there's a lot of argumentation held about the pro Pep Band group because it's student run and they deserve to be there, and that's how things are done at UVA. And then there's the anti Pep Band because of shifting institutional priorities.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and as you mentioned, a timely donation of, I think it was $1.5 million, if I'm not mistaken, came in to establish the traditional marching band. So, you know, once they got that, you know, the Pep Band, the band did play on, as Ron said, you know, they would play community events, they would play club sports. I think they'd play at different, things in Charlottesville. They played at some Washington Capitals games, the Nats up in D.C. also. So they had another, you know, 7 or 8 years, but it was hard to get people interested in joining the band when there was really, you know, no chance of them ever really being officially, recognized by the university. But it was interesting. One thing I didn't get to put in the story, I wish I had time, but I couldn't put everything in. In 2004, there was a joint resolution introduced in the General Assembly to honor the Pep Band on its 30th anniversary. And, you know, those things always pass. I mean, that's just, you know, it's like, it's a resolution. Sure, they generally pass. So it died in the Senate. So there was still some lingering feelings there. There were a couple of politicians, Virginia politicians, who over the years had made threats, you know, to legislate somehow the Pep Band out of existence. So they did, joint resolution failed, but there was a House resolution that passed. So it was, it died in the Senate. So even, you know, 30 years on, there was still some lingering feelings there about the Pep Band.
Well, along those same lines, I would just point out that in 1997, the band petitioned the U.S. Congress to see if they could become the official band of Congress. And they received several letters back saying, thank you, but we don't really have an official band of Congress. And to me, that just epitomized the pep band. that somebody would come up with the idea, hey, let's go to the U.S. Congress and see if they'll make us their official band. That just cracked me up when I came across that in the files.
So, Ron, you talk about the files. We've got about 45 seconds left. You're working on a documentary film.
Right. I'm working with Chris Farina, who's a filmmaker in Charlottesville, and we're hopefully going to tell the story of the band. We think it's a great story. We really want to capture the fun and the humor and the creativity and the camaraderie and just really tell this story that we, those of us that were part of it, feel so strongly about and feel that it was such an important part of our lives. So we're working on that, and hopefully once we get out of COVID, we'll start filming and start working on a reunion show where we can perform one last show.
Oh, a reunion show. How would that happen?
Well, we're hoping to find a location where we can invite alumni back, Pep Band alumni back, and we'll put together maybe the best of. We haven't worked out all the logistics of it, but the idea is that we can bring people back, do a show, and then do a number of interviews with people while everybody's here.
All right. Folks, thank you so much for listening to the history and tales of UVA's Pep Band. Ron Culberson is a speaker, an author, a humorist, a graduate of UVA in 1983, as well as being a member of the Pep Band on the writing committee and a field conductor. We also had Ed Miller, associate editor at Virginia Magazine and author of the recent article, Pep Band, the Pep Band's 30 Years of Scrambling on the Edge. You can find that at the Virginia Magazine. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Fascinating and funny. I loved it. I was a big fan of the Pep Band.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks. See you next Sunday.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.